Oh, this is great. So great. This is really great.
Hello, everybody. This is Again With This, Melrose Place. Today's episode is Season 3, Episode 11, The Days of Wine and Vodka. And now here are your hosts, Tara Ariano and Sarah D. Bunting.
Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Tara and Dave.
Hello to our listeners as well. I wanted to tell you about Again With This, episode 32 for our Patreon supporters. That will be dropping January 29th. Our topic is, let's watch Cheryl Pollock in the series premiere of Hull High. It seems to be the only episode of Hull High that is still on YouTube, but It is. We'll link it in the show notes if you want to watch it first. It is part of the wave of musical TV series that all happened and failed in 1990. Why? Who's to say for sure? We will definitely speculate. So that's coming up this Friday, January 29th, for our Patreon supporters.
We'll also be dropping our January episode of Again With Them the day before that, January 28th. That is exclusively for our Patreons at the $5 level and up.
That one's going to be covering 5 episodes of 90210 OMG. We may die. So,
yeah. Two times speed. Hello.
Wow. So all of that is available to you at patreon.com/againwiththis. And we thank our Patreons for their support and for all of our listeners for listening. On to this episode, Days of Wine and Vodka, starting with our E-plot. Amanda's ascendance at D&D gets an assist from Peter. Poor Bruce. Turns to the office, still sounding kind of feeble. When Amanda says he should be at home, he says he can't. News of his heart attack leaked to the press. Now the agency's stock is plummeting, and the longer he's gone, the worse it gets. The agency is at risk of a takeover. In fact, someone's already bought a big chunk of agency stock. It's under the disclosure point to the SEC, so he doesn't know who, but we do. He knows the leak was deliberate. This is all happening too fast. And Amanda urges him to go home. She'll cover for him. And so he says he will for a couple of hours and then come back. Why? Look, bro, maybe you had a heart attack because you're bad at relaxing. Like, just go home and don't come back.
Yeah. Also, it's Los Angeles. Like, you're going to get to relax for 12 minutes. Then you got to get back in the car. No.
Yeah. Just if you're going to do that, just work for however long you were planning to work, then leave for the day. Come on. As soon as he's gone, Amanda calls Peter and asks him about the stock buy. This is apparently the first she's learning that she did it. Well, she and Peter, via an investment group she has just found out she's part of, which, not how we scheme, guy. Tell everybody involved what they're doing. It's only polite.
I assumed it was a plausible deniability thing, but still, yeah.
Fair enough. I mean, I don't know why she didn't hear someone bought up a huge block of stock and didn't immediately think it was him, but whatever.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Some days later, Amanda's in Peter's office talking to Bruce on the phone. He's back in the office at the agency. Amanda's having conscience pangs as she says Bruce sounds scared. He lost a fortune in D&D stock. It was his retirement fund, his kids' college tuitions. She just can't do this to him. And Peter just gazes at her appraisingly. She mumbles that she wants to pull out. And Peter side-eyes her some more before kneeling in front of her to give her the hard sell in clip 2.
You've been working with him for a long time. And you have a bond. But take him off his pedestal, Amanda. This is the same man who stole your thunder with the KDEE account, who took Chaz's side in the harassment suit. And those are just the things I know about.
But this is different. He's sick.
Because he's blatantly ignoring medical advice. You're just not used to playing corporate raider, are you? Here I thought you ate survival of the fittest for breakfast.
Under these circumstances.
So, Amanda Woodward is having a crisis of conscience. And she's human. But it's too late to pull back now. The train's already on the track. I'm sorry, darling.
Please pick one metaphor. Please pick one.
Yeah. I mean, it works. And once again, much as I said, Andrew Williams calling me sweetheart might make me do a lot of terrible things. Peter Burns calling me darling. Same thing.
Yeah.
Kind of worked on me.
Oh, it definitely would have worked on me. I'm just saying.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know it would have worked on
Once
you.
Once he's out of the room, it's like, wait, trains now? If he's present, though, yeah, the digmatization will succeed.
Especially if he's kneeling in front of you, like,
yeah,
you know, come on.
Hair gel gleaming in the firelight.
The little glint. Wow. All right, moving on. That's literally all that happens with that plot line in this episode. Moving on to our D plot, Matt's parents' Thanksgiving invitation comes with strings. Matt and Jeffrey are out for lunch with Matt's parents, which seems to be going well. Mr. Fielding particularly impressed with Jeff's recent travel to Alaska, which is funny. It like seems like a random detail, but I was like, oh, dads do love Alaska.
I had that in my notes that I was like, Jeffrey is complete dad nip.
Yeah. So with a significant look toward Matt, Jeffrey says he plans to stay in California for a while. And Matt then uncomfortably breaks the spell by saying he has to get back to work. And his parents are going to stay and have coffee. So Jeffrey offers to go get the car. And when he's gone, both elder Fieldings express their approval, which is sweet. With Thanksgiving coming up, Matt has been wondering if he may bring Jeffrey to dinner. And they readily agree. On the next night, Matt is testy as he sets his and Jeffrey's dinner plates down at the table. Jeffrey thinks he's having second thoughts about him, but it's not Jeffrey. His dad surprised him at work today. Why this happened off screen, don't know. I mean, I do know.
Seriously.
It's because it's Matt, but still bullshit.
They could only afford one day of that guy. He was the same guy, but I think had no lines, basically. Like,
yeah.
Guys.
Weird. He adds that his parents really like Jeffrey, but Mr. Fielding wants them to tell everyone at dinner that they're just good friends because he and Mrs. Fielding don't think that the family can handle the truth. So Jeffrey, who again only came out this calendar year, scoffs about what Matt's parents think will happen if they tell the truth. Like, not to say this request isn't bullshit coming from Matt's parents. It totally is. But it's not as though Jeffrey doesn't at least know a few of the reasons why people hide their sexuality from each other, whether they should or not. Like, get off your high horse a little bit, Jeffrey. I'm just saying, like, this is Matt's fight, not yours, perhaps.
Whatever. Yeah. I mean, Jeffrey's always looking for reasons to be in a snit, and here's one now.
That's true. So Matt says whatever might happen, his parents don't want to risk it. And suddenly Jeffrey's all Mr. Act Up 1994 as he says he won't go back in the closet. Matt says he won't either. So Matt ends up showing up to the house alone on the day. He brought pies since he had promised to bring dessert. And he's very cordial as he tells his mother he and Jeffrey will not be coming for dinner because they can't live by the elder Fielding's rules. And Mrs. Fielding is dismayed. Sure, they can find some middle ground, but Matt says it's not enough, and he kisses her on the cheek and heads out, and she asks where she should say he is, and instead of saying, it's not my job to keep up appearances, Constance, he says this, clip 3.
Why don't you just tell them I'm having dinner with my lover?
I mean, team Matt, obviously,
of
but
course.
The minute lover came out of his mouth, that she's like, oh, come on. Like, yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
But like, I'm not telling them anything of the sort.
Yes, but
I will use the word boyfriend. Mm-hmm. I'm not a monster.
Well, she's not going to say anything. She'll, you know.
No, she's not.
He's out of town. I don't know. Whatever.
Got the same food poisoning as Bruce did.
On to our C plot. Kimberly and Joe scheme to avoid an unfavorable court ruling. So we join Michael and Kimberly in a lawyer's office, learning what's involved in adoption. Kimberly would, of course, like to have an idea of what kind of financial outlay could be involved. And I have to say, getting told it's a range of $2,500 to $100,000 potentially is totally unhelpful. Like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like, what adoption even in 1994 would have been as cheap as $2,500, I would like to know.
I know. Like, is there, like, some fine print where it's, like, when someone shows up with, like, a Rhodesian Ridgeback that has, like, a biting problem that you're like, it's like, well, you signed this. Enjoy your puppy.
Like, so Kimberly is aghast, and Michael reminds her that he, or they, or whatever, owes $40,000 in student loans, which... That amount sounds adorable right now. But anyway,
yeah. Also, aren't they making, this is hilarious, but the show says that this is happening. Aren't they making that sweet Mancini Designs bank?
Right. I don't know. The show can't decide if it's a lot of money or not a lot of money, like from episode to episode. So hard to say.
Yeah, true.
So he seems to think that that's decided the matter and gets up saying they're out of their league and preparing to leave. But Kimberly, still seated, tells him he's being cavalier and he claims he would do it if she could find the money. Some number of days later, Kimberly ends up in the office of a fertility specialist played by the sex ed teacher from 90210, the one who was always rubbing his beard. It's that guy.
Oh.
He interrupts her monologue to repeat what he already told her. She will not be physically able to carry a pregnancy to term. He tries to recommend a therapist to help her deal with the situation, but... Clip 4.
Do you really want to help me, doctor? Then tell me about black market babies.
I mean, I had just made a note that was like, get off, like, fucking get on with it, basically, with the subplot. And then she's like, you really want to help me? Like, point me to an illegal child. Like, thank you. That's very efficient. Not realistic, but I appreciate it.
So because it's a soap, he is not immediately like, absolutely not, and get out, psycho, but rather lets her babble on about things he must have heard about in his line of work. He does eventually get around to saying it's illegal and unethical and that he is personally grossed out by her for even asking such a thing. But she snaps that it's easy for him to pass judgment when he has 3 children. When in such a way that it sort of makes it seem like, that's a lot. Would you really miss one if I took one, perhaps?
I didn't even think of it that way, but yeah.
So when she's on her way out, Joe's in the waiting room again. She says hi and asks if Kimberly's, you know, pregnant, like she thought she was the other day. Kimberly says she's not, but that they're still trying. And then she sits down and asks if Joe is okay, which is weird. And Joe faintly says she's fine, but it only takes one more query before she tells Kimberly the outcome of the custody case. Kimberly's horrified. Joe can't leave California, and she can't leave the hospital with her baby. So then Kimberly comes by Joe's later that night, unannounced, with a proposal to help Joe keep her baby. And it's dark? Clip 5.
I think I have a way to make everyone believe that your baby's dead.
What?
Think about it, Joe. If everyone believes your baby's dead, then you're free. You can take your baby wherever you want, away from the court, away from the Carters.
How?
We'll induce labor a week before your due date. Then we'll deliver the baby at the beach house. And we'll tell everyone it was stillborn.
Oh my God. I do all the paperwork at county. They have so many patients there, we'd get lost in the shuffle. Then I'll sign a fetal death certificate and tell everybody the body's been cremated. No one will ever know.
I don't know.
Think about it, Joe. It's a way out. It may be your only way.
Why would you do this for me? You barely know me.
Because I hope that if I'm ever a mother, somebody will help me.
And because I believe that mothers need to be with their babies. Come to the beach house for Thanksgiving Day dinner, and you can let me know your answer then. But Joe, nobody can know about this, not even Michael. It'll be our secret. You, me, and your baby.
Yikes.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not superstitious, but I feel like we'll pretend your baby is dead. It's like, that's anyone who was pregnant would be like, this conversation is over.
Yeah,
like,
no, that's like a neon sign that says Maloik and an arrow pointing to your womb. No, dude.
No. However, this is a soap, so Joe goes. Kimberly considerately makes cranberry juice cocktail, which sounds super good to me, by the way. Mm-hmm. Joe talks about the stories she's heard about the feats of strength that mothers can perform when their children are in danger. And Kimberly agrees that a mother's love is the stuff of legends, and then adds that she's Joe's last hope. And Joe thinks maybe Kimberly is right. Her baby is in danger. So she's in with this crazy plan that everyone can see where it's going except for Joe, because she does not know that Kimberly is infertile.
Oh my God. I was actually a little surprised that the cranberry juice cocktail didn't already have like knockout drops
right.
in it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
All right. On to the B plot. Jake is getting blackmailed and Jane's terrible taste in men is to blame.
Oh boy.
Jane comes to Sydney's door to say she's going to Chicago for Thanksgiving and she thinks Sydney should come. Sydney is dubious given how things went the last time she saw their dad, what with him having her committed and all. And Jane seems to think there is a possibility for Sydney and their parents to make peace, despite the fact that Jane herself has not made peace with Sydney and they see each other all the time. But Sydney says she doesn't intend to speak to their parents again as long as she lives. And I personally think that is a fine choice. Add Jane to that list, by the way.
Yeah, really.
So then Jake is puttering around at Shooters when, hey, it's that Al Sapienza walks in.
Oh, Mikey Palmisi.
That's the R.I.P. one. You have seen this guy 1 billion times, of course, as Sarah said, in 10 episodes of The Sopranos as Mikey Palmisi. I thought I was going to scroll down and see that this was one of his earliest roles, but actually he was on General Hospital in 1963 when he was 8.
So, wait, are you sure?
Well, that's what IMDb said.
Huh.
I don't know.
Okay.
I looked for a photo. I did not find one. So it's possible that it was a different Al Sapienza that was like, you know, it was misfiled or something. Anyway.
It was actually Al Lettieri from The Godfather. Anyway. Yeah, it's that skeezy gangster who agrees to flip on some guy who hired him to kill his wife on Law and Order.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen this guy.
You have Absolutely. Seen him 1 million billion times. Like, there's not a procedural he has not been on, basically.
Correct.
So here his name is Mr. Black, and he seems to know a lot about the business. Clip 6.
Of course, you're paying 10% over market for paper goods, but that's okay. You're establishing credit. And you're using top shelf liquor for your mixed drinks. Shows good faith to your customers. Looks like you got yourself a solid business here. I'd like to keep it that way. Who are you and what the hell do you want?
My name is Mr. Black.
And my boss and I, you know, I mean, in a way, we're good Samaritans. We like to see to it that new businesses get off to a good start. I'll see that the place doesn't get robbed, deliveries arrive on time, windows don't break, you know, stuff like that. How much does, security like that go for these days?
Neighborhood of $1,000 a month.
Go back and you tell your boss I wouldn't give him a quarter for the parking meter.
You really should think this over when you have a clearer head. Now you're lucky I'm a fair man. I'll give you another chance. Don't blow it.
Oh dear.
I mean, really, Jake? Who are you? You know who he is.
Yeah.
Don't you watch TV when you get home at night?
He probably doesn't. He seems kind of boring.
Yeah,
true. We've seen him read a magazine and like that one book of poetry that Joe gave him, and like that's kind of it. So Sydney witnessed some of this and warns Jake not to fuck around. She saw how this shit works when she was with Lauren. But Jake says that if you appease these guys, they own you. They can take their protection and go to hell. Bold talk. Some number of days later, Jake goes to put some boxes in the alley and sees Mr. Black there lurking. He was just wondering if Jake had thought any more about his offer, but Jake is standing firm on you're not getting a dime, which is when a couple of Mr. Black's goons appear out of nowhere and basically throw an oil drum at the back of Jake's head. Like,
I was not supposed to laugh at that, listener. I giggled.
There's a gif. Like, it's it really seems like a very fast escalation. Like, punch him first. It seriously is like the biggest thing that they could find to throw at him.
It was like a troll hammer. Like, I don't know, maybe if one of them cough from behind him pointedly and then with the fisticuffs.
Right.
Yeah.
Before you find Captain America's shield and like try to kill him with it. Anyway. Jake has 24 hours to make his first installment or things are going to get worse. Jake grunts at Mr. Black to go to hell. Mr. Black remains calm as he explains the situation in clip 7.
It's yin and yang, Jake. The system of checks and balances.
You were due for a reward, the government slicked you. You bought the bot, now it's your turn to pay.
Payback's a bitch.
Only from your end.
He's so good.
He really is.
I mean, granted,
like, I don't know. My notes are like repeatedly like, it's Mikey Palmisi. Just pay him now. And eventually, Paul, you'll shoot him and you'll be off the hook. It's fine.
Yeah. I mean, this is clearly a role that Al Sapienza can play in his sleep, in a coma, dead. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not a challenge for him, but it's still very enjoyable to watch.
Yeah. I mean, he still puts the effort in. Like, he's still a skeezy Mr. Black type every time. And I appreciate that consistency of quality.
I agree. So he's just departed with his assistants when Sydney and her giant jeans, are back.
Oh, why? Why is this still happening?
The giant jeans and their congressman have come out the back to help him up. And then she gets a good look at Mr. Black in the process. So when Sydney comes back to the complex that night and Mr. Black is lurking in the shadows there waiting for her, she recognizes him. She asks what he wants. He wants to make some plans. He figured she had some time to kill since she's not going to Chicago for Thanksgiving. She asks who told him that, and he goes on, repeating the details of the Andrews family celebrations that Jane tried to tempt her with earlier. She tries to walk away, but he, of course, grabs what? Let's all say it together. Her arm.
Her arm.
He knew she looked familiar, and then he remembered that she used to work for Lauren. His boss has a friend who might be interested in a trade. Her services in exchange for them lightening up on Jake. She refuses, so Mr. Black explains the stakes. If she does not cooperate, Jake will meet with an industrial accident. At a bar, legs get severed, hands get smashed. At a bar? I mean, maybe
also,
I...
like, didn't we all see the Law and Order with Mike Starr of Goodfellas, among other things, where he's like, it's not good business for me to fuck up the clients so they can't pay.
Right. Like, yeah.
Ugh.
But
the
I
mafia
would also
doesn't still exist by doing it like this, but okay.
Right. At the same time, I also kind of just want to play this out and be like, yeah, explain how Jake's leg got severed at the bar. Like, that's a real sharp ice pick.
He was like cutting up some lemons and with a hatchet. I don't even know how you do that.
He was using the traditional tool that one uses, a scythe. And anyway, so when he puts it this way, Sydney agrees to do it. So details will follow soon. So when Sydney shows up for the assignation at a hotel bar, Mr. Black is there to hand off the room key. She tells him to fuck off, basically, and he notes that she's tough, but so is his boss's friend. And with no other option, she goes up to the room to hold up her end of the deal, and clip 8.
Hello, Sydney. Thanks for coming.
No.
Jake shouldn't have hit me, Sydney. Not me.
No, please.
He underestimated my connections. All the friendships that I've made in America. That was a big mistake. And I thought it was so obvious. All my trips to Las Vegas.
Please, I'm begging you. I'll get Jake to apologize.
That is not what I want. I've gone to a lot of trouble to organize all of this, mischief. Now come to bed.
Why are you doing this? You're supposed to be in love with my sister.
Jane lacks that slutty quality that you have in spades, Sydney.
Among other things.
You can go. But if you do, I'll see to it that Jake is unrecognizable to his own mother. Your choice.
I mean...
Okay, first of all, his mother's a drunk, so he's probably unrecognizable to her already.
Literally exactly what my notes say.
Oh, I'm glad you also remember that. I was quite proud of myself for the recall on that. Second of all... In a bar?
Yeah.
Third of all, it does occur to me that perhaps Chris's single-minded pursuit of the ruination of Sydney's life could be leveraged against him, but yeah. I mean, I just wish he would get on with doing what he's really going to do and then get killed or whatever happens to him, but
yeah.
Laura Layton is acting the hell out of this bonkersosity, so good for her.
She is. And the other thing that happens at this point in the scene is that she agrees because she doesn't want Jake to get hurt, and so the camera switches to handheld, which really makes the scene feel like claustrophobic and gross and awful, even more so than it would otherwise, which is quite
well. And it often does, because she is very short, and like, even if he were only 5'7", he would be looming over her, but he's not. He's real tall, and he's committed, this dude. Mm-hmm. So, ugh. I mean, it's soapy as hell, but they're selling it.
Yep. But also, just to call back to the wedding episode, see, we were right. All his trips to Las Vegas, red flag, red flag. Mm-hmm. Finally, our A plot. Allison is a drunk and a mean one. Real mean. So Allison is lurking in the courtyard waiting for Joe and her quasi Starfleet look. I don't know. You can see in the visual aids. It's like red to the tits and then black from there down. Quasi Starfleet. I feel like I nailed it.
I do feel like a Star Trek episode director would have cautioned Daphne Zuniga not to just be constantly rubbing her belly. Like, we can see the pregnancy pad. Got it.
We can. So she's waiting for Joe to come out so that Allison can importune her for a reinstatement of their friendship. Joe ignores her. And who can possibly blame her, until Allison asks if Joe is speaking to her, and Joe snaps that they both have shit to deal with, so they can do that separately and talk later. The Allison whine has been dormant for a while, but it is back in full effect as she babbles that she feels horrible about what happened in court. Not what she did, notably.
Right.
But Joe is not having it. Clip 9.
You knew more than anyone what this case meant to me. I asked you for one thing, and you showed up so strung out on God knows what. You couldn't even walk and chew gum at the same time.
I had too much coffee, that's all. I'm sorry if I appeared jittery. I can't argue with you about this.
I told everyone you were my best friend. Someone you could set your watch by, someone who you could count on in emergencies. The one you'd call first if anything happened to my baby. And you looked and you smelled like you spent the night in a brewery.
I'm sorry. I wanted to be there for you.
Yeah. But you weren't. And I can't trust you anymore. And I don't want you to be my baby's godmother.
Yikes, I mean, but good call.
Well, yeah, and fair. Also, that's not your call. Like, if the Carters want to reinstate her, they can. Just kidding, they won't. Also, that's not how it's going to go, I'm sure. We've all watched TV before.
Yes.
This, like, Zuniga's acting starts to kind of lose the handle a little bit at some point, and I think this is the point.
Mm.
Like, her line deliveries are just... I don't know if they were still shooting like three episodes at a time at this point or what, but it's not great, especially compared to what everyone else is doing in scenes with her. So,
right.
Yeah. Not great.
Interesting.
But also Allison is terrible.
She really is. So, Susan's alarm goes off at some ungodly early hour and she ignores Billy's protests to head out to the produce wholesalers. She can't have lunch that day, as he suggests, but promises to hang out in bed all day on their next day off. He's going to be off on Thursday for Thanksgiving, and she says she was thinking she would cook to make peace with their neighbors. One in particular. She's not working in the kitchen on the holiday at the restaurant where she just started working 5 minutes ago? Sure.
Mm.
Billy is fine with her Thanksgiving plan as long as she is the one to ask Allison. She lists all the French dishes she wants to make, but he has to boringly say it's a traditional holiday and no one's going to want to eat anything they can't pronounce. Like, not everyone is as boring or scared of the world as you, turd. Yeah. Out at lunch, Allison asks Zach if he thinks she has a drinking problem, because clearly a guy who carries speed to fight hangovers would know. He wants to know whoever gave her such a wild idea, and she tells him what Joe said. He counters that Allison's so-called friend has invented Allison's drinking problem to blame her for what happened with her case. Like, what happened with her case is Allison torpedoed it by being drunk. Guy, maybe don't bring that up. But Allison says Amanda thinks she has a drinking problem, too. But Zach writes her off as someone whose convict father was just killed by his hit woman girlfriend, as though that has anything to do with the matter at hand or Amanda's judgment of it.
Also, are you a crime reporter also? Like, how did you even know that?
Honestly.
Whatever.
So he urges Allison to think, I guess she could have told him. He urges Allison to think about what she needs. What's the one thing she's been denying herself? She says she needs a car. She tried to sell Betsy a few months ago. She did? But no one would take
it. That was like two seasons ago, but okay. Should have kept the Jeep from Steve.
Yeah. So they toast on this, great start, and set off to remedy her situation. So apparently everyone has to buy a stupid convertible, including Allison. She's not sure how she's going to afford it, but Zach carelessly says she'll figure it out and then gets on her car phone to make a reservation at a hotel in Santa Barbara. She says she has to get back to work, but he ignores her. It's one afternoon. She had one meeting. It's been canceled, but she has another one first thing in the morning. She can't stay over in Santa Barbara, which, like, it actually is not that far. It's like an hour. It's just not very convenient. But Zach says phase two of her new life is believing she deserves good things. Phase one was just getting the car, I guess. He claims they don't have to spend the night at this ranch in Santa Barbara. They can drive back to L.A. that night if she wants, which, like, the only person who doesn't know they're just both going to get too shit-faced to drive anywhere is Allison, who agrees. And one cut later, they're drinking wine in bed in front of a fire. He asks if she still wants to go back to L.A., but she doesn't want to go back ever. She hasn't been this happy in her entire life. She owes him so much. He denies that. She's amazing, beautiful, talented, etc. And then says he loves her, and she says it back. You met 4 days ago. like
God. And have you, I mean, not to be gross, but that is my job. Have y'all even been able to fuck thanks to Whiskey Dick? There I asked.
It's a very fair question.
Thank you.
And to your point, he suggests putting another log on the fire because it's going to be a long night. And when she does, by the time she gets back to the bed, he has fully passed out in like,
like
10 seconds.
Immobile, like not moving.
I've lost
all.
Track of what's innuendo and what's not in this conversation. Put another log on the fire, eh?
In that case, it's literally another log. Oh, God. So then once again, Allison wakes up next to Zach, completely wrecked, late for an important obligation.
Completely what?
Wrecked.
Oh, not e-wrecked.
No.
No. Also, it's called a wake-up call. Does this place not have a front desk? Come on.
Yeah. This time the obligation is her meeting, which is in 15 minutes, and which she's not going to make because she's still in Santa Barbara and it is in LA. And they go back and forth about this, like, whatever. He finally talks her out of, like, worrying about it and just says, call in sick and go in the middle of the day. And she does. And then they start fucking in the clothes that they slept in with their awful, rancid, drunk breath. Like, disgusting. I'm sorry. Like, I'm glad you're both free spirits, but this seems absolutely revolting to me. But good for you, I guess. Whatever. Seems like they did it, finally. To answer your question, this is they've done it at least one time.
Great.
So then, in front of what I'm pretty sure is the Beverly Hilton, Billy and Alice and Amanda are waiting against Amanda's Porsche when Allison comes screaming around the corner in her new car with the radio blasting, probably whacked out on goofballs again. Amanda sternly exposits that this lunch is about Allison's account. Amanda had to cancel a bunch of her own shit to prepare for it, and if she found out Allison called out from work to buy a car, she's going to be fired. Billy, the teacher's pet, correctly lists the sequence of events that ended with Allison showing up here, and when Allison claims he guessed wrong, Amanda thinks he's right, actually, given that Allison's still wearing the same clothes she had on yesterday. Whoops.
Oh, gross.
Mm-hmm. And Allison's response to both of them is basically, I'm here now, shut up. And then she just goes in, like, good one. So then Susan gets home after work and suggests a movie, but Billy tells her to go ahead without him, and she guesses he's having one of those days. And she's not sure what to do since she's never seen him like this. Does he want her to leave him alone, joke, dance naked, make him talk? And instead of saying, dance naked, please, former IRL model, he theatrically sighs, it's Allison, she's out of control. Oh, wow, it's nice that after everything, he's concerned about her health and well-being, and wait, no, I'm hearing that's not what's on his mind at all. Clip 10.
It directly affects me, you know. I mean, if she screws up at work, then my work gets screwed up. It's really hard to just sit there and watch her sabotage her life.
What happened?
Well, she bought a new car that I know she can't afford. Then she shows up at this important lunch looking like hell and either loaded or hungover. Is she still coming to Thanksgiving dinner?
She hasn't given me an answer yet.
Maybe our relationship's just making it worse. Maybe it's better not to invite her.
Look, Allison has to take responsibility for herself. Doesn't mean that it wouldn't be easier for her to know that people cared about her. Maybe we could invite her new boyfriend with her and keep it just the four of us.
I hate that guy.
But she doesn't.
Yeah, well.
If Allison's going to show up at all, she needs the invitation to come from you.
Fine.
No. No. Don't invite her. No.
Give each other space. Like, everyone doesn't have to be friends with everyone all the time.
Yeah. Also, it's you.
Yeah. Also,
I mean,
if you hate
I'd
her
rather
boyfriend,
have
like
liquid Thanksgiving than spend it with you.
Yeah. But also, like, if you hate her boyfriend, don't hang out with him. Like, just wait for them to break up, as they're probably going to, you know.
Yeah. Like, you're on a soap. It's not going to be long. Just let it ride.
Yeah.
And also,
you're in your 20s, that too. Like, yeah. They're not going to get married. Just wait. So the next morning, Billy sees Allison leaving for work and apologizes for being such a bitch to her at lunch the day before. I'm paraphrasing. Allison assumes it started with Amanda and filtered down to him, which is more or less true. So he wants to know, is she coming to Thanksgiving dinner or not? She ruefully laughs that she thinks it would be uncomfortable, what with everything that's happened between them and Susan and work and for everyone else, too. But Billy says it would just be the three of them or four if she wants to bring Zach. Like, please don't. You just started dating this guy 6 days ago. Surely he already had plans to get high, probably, but that's still plans. And she doesn't answer, so Billy says they have to make a conscious effort to get along. No, you don't. So nope. She agrees to go and takes off. And he's like, see you then. And she waves back without turning around, which is honestly one of the cooler things she's ever done. I made a GIF. You can see in the visual aids where she's like, bye.
It's true. She doesn't even ask if she can bring anything. She's just like, no. Fine.
Yep. I mean, and to be fair, he's the one who's forcing it. So like, if you're going to make this happen, I'm not going to make it easy for her, for you. Like,
yeah, I'm also not going to make a side dish. Bite me.
So then it's Thanksgiving night. She's alone in her apartment calling Zach, who is supposed to be there already, but some of his college friends stopped by last minute, so he's not going to make it.
That did not look last minute either.
Did not.
That looked like they showed up first thing with a 24-pack each and are not going anywhere until Sunday when football is over, but
yep.
All right.
But she should come over later, he says. He is not susceptible to her whining at all and hangs up on her mid-whimper. So she downs her large vodka beverage and heads up to Billy's, where she coldly hands him a bottle of wine and mumbles that Zach can't make it because something came up. Billy shrugs and does not interrogate this. And then Susan comes out and Allison submits to her hug before Susan also asks where Zach is. And clip 11.
Oh, he's not coming.
Oh, well, that'll give us a chance to talk. About what? Talk about what, Susan?
That sigh. So good.
So good.
Really. So Billy ushers them all over to the couch where a half-assed intervention ensues. Clip 12.
Ever since you started seeing this guy, Zach, you've completely changed. I mean, you're irresponsible. You're alienating all your friends. And if you keep it up, you're probably going to lose your job. That's bad news, Allison. Susan thinks so, too.
Well, I don't know him personally, but he's obviously influencing you.
You are unbelievable. Who the hell are you, anyway? A moral majority of two? You don't know what's in my head or in my heart. You make no effort to find out.
That's not true. That's not fair.
You just can't take the fact that I am fine with your being a couple. And I have a new boyfriend who's crazy about me. I hope that the two of you are very happy in your neurotic little love nest. I, for one, am leaving and going home.
Allison.
Get your hand off me!
I don't know why I thought we could have a conversation. You were drunk when you walked in. Go ahead. Sleep it off.
Ooh.
Nice. Oh.
I mean, they're not wrong. Like, Zach clearly is bad news. But also, like, this really is a situation that calls for some of Winston Churchill's better, you know, drunk rejoinders. Like, both of you just fuck off. You've been a couple for 5 minutes longer than me and Zach have. So stow it.
Also, it's Billy. Like, you're making me side with Allison when she's clearly wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Take a long, hard look in the mirror there.
Yeah.
Flycatcher.
Mm-hmm. So then Allison drunkly drives her new car towards Zach's, telling him on the car phone that she loves football. This claim has been disputed. It's clear from her half of the conversation that his half is just a bunch of reasons why she shouldn't come over until his friends all leave, whereas she wants to come now. And she's pulling up to a stop sign as she takes her eyes off the road to hang her car phone back up, which is when a biker comes down a hill. And though she slams on the brake and half spins out, she still hits him. I mean, technically he hits her, but obviously she's at fault because she's the one in a car. And then the guy just lies in the road motionless as she gasps in horror. And that's where we leave it. Da, 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 da. Dramatic. All right. Let us close things up with our episode MVP. Boy, this is a tough one. I'm going to say Matt for telling his mother off because they were wrong.
Yeah, it's true. I'm going to say Courtney Thorne Smith.
All right. She's
doing
very
great.
Good. She is still least valuable player. Kimberly for some yeah. real wacky ideas about where babies should come into her life from.
Yeah. Allison driving drunk repeatedly.
Yeah.
Could have killed somebody. It's not good.
No, it's not. Good choices.
Next time on Again With This, Allison gets arrested, Amanda gets fired, Sydney gets kidnapped, and Joe gets wise to Kimberly's plans. Is it too late? It's never too late for you to get close to a fistful of Tums before checking out our visual aids. We do those for every episode of Again With This, and you'll find them on our website, againwiththispodcast.com. That's also where you'll find a link to buy our very special 90210 book, available in all formats. To learn more, follow us on Twitter at AWT90210. And don't make us send Mikey Palmisi over to strong arm you. Just go to our Patreon page at patreon.com/againwiththis. Tons of extra security. So join today. I'm typecast gangster Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. My co-host is deeply unlucky nighttime bike rider Tara Ariano, and she's on Twitter at Tara Ariano. And our producer is unpronounceable entree David T. Cole. Talk to you next time. Ooh. What?